From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The U.S. is back in Iraq. Airstrikes and aid in the north, where the Islamic militant group ISIS has chased thousands of Iraqi minorities out of their homes. Now the U.S. is involved and could be involved for months, says President Obama. No boots on the ground is the promise, but with an Iraqi government that has failed to come together and a determined terrorist group controlling cities and oil fields, what will the future hold? The Iraqi future, the American future. This hour on Point, American intervention in Iraq. You can join us on air or online. What went through your mind when you heard the U.S. was in Iraq again? Was it, is it the right call? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We have a special welcome to our new listeners on 101.9 Detroit's public radio station. We welcome you. Joining me now first from Iraq with the Iraqi picture is Matt Bradley. He's Middle East reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He's in Baghdad today. Matt, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Well, thank you. Tell us how things are going in Baghdad. Iraq's new president has nominated a prime minister to replace Nouri al-Maliki. Give us the latest on this power struggle going on right now in Baghdad.
It's a decisive moment right now because the president, who was just recently elected only last month, has just nominated a man other than Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki for the premiership here in Iraq. And so we're seeing the beginnings of what could be a major confrontation. And we don't know how this is going to take shape because this literally just happened in the last hour. Mm. Prime Minister Maliki last night gave a blistering speech in which he accused the president of undermining the constitution and the public will by not nominating a new premier in time for a constitutionally mandated deadline. Now that the president has gone ahead and nominated someone other than Mr. Maliki, we don't know whether Mr. Maliki is going to decide to protect his office using his authority over the security forces, which is something that would amount to effectively a coup d'etat, or whether he will willingly step aside. So there's a lot that's going to be happening in the next couple of hours here in Baghdad.
And so last night, speaking in Sydney, Australia, Secretary of State John Kerry warned the Iraqi Prime Minister al-Maliki against interfering with the process of picking this new Iraqi leader.
There will be little international support of any kind whatsoever for anything that deviates from the legitimate constitutional process that is in place and being worked on now. They need to finish that and give a new government an opportunity to be voted on and move forward.
And here he is, Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, striking back against calls for his resignation and the accused Iraq's new president, Fuad Masum, of violating the country's constitution.
The president of the republic has breached the constitution twice. The first time when he extended the period of which he had to announce the candidate of the biggest bloc in parliament. The period expired last Thursday, the 7th of August. The second time he deliberately breached the constitution again was when he did not choose a candidate from the State of Law coalition, which is the biggest parliamentary bloc.
So, Matt Bradley, you talk about a major confrontation possible here. There are reports in the Iraqi news media of troop movements in Baghdad. Is there concern that al-Maliki is really digging in for a fight here?
Well, that was the major concern last night when the troop movements first occurred. And that happened in the hour just preceding Mr. Maliki's televised speech in which he gave this tirade against the president, the speech that you just played. So now we're wondering whether the troops are going to be strengthened, whether we're going to see Mr. Maliki use his position as commander-in-chief of the army and the ruling officer over the security forces domestically to protect his position. So there is a very real concern that this could amount to some sort of power grab by Maliki.
And this choice by the Iraqi president is a very public snubbing of Nouri al-Maliki, is it not?
It is indeed, especially since Haider al-Abadi comes from Mr. Maliki's own political party, the Dawa Party, which is also the major party within the State of Law coalition. It's Maliki's coalition. And the State of Law is a major party within the National Alliance, which just nominated Haider al-Abadi several hours ago as its selection for the premiership. So this is all looking like a lot of different political forces swirling around here in Baghdad and uniting against Mr. Maliki just in the last 24 hours. And a lot of that, what we're hearing from our sources, is that a lot of that is coming from this speech last night, the speech that you just played, in which Mr. Maliki seemed to offend a lot of people who otherwise might have been his allies and have been for years. Mm.
Matt Bradley is a Middle East reporter for The Wall Street Journal, reporting from Baghdad. Thank you, Matt, very much.
Thank you.
Well, now we turn to the big picture, the U.S., aid, bombs, and Iraq. Joining me now in New York City is NPR's Deborah Amos. She covers the Middle East and has spent many months and years reporting from Iraq's Kurdish capital, Erbil, in the north. She's author of Eclipse of the Sunnis and Lines in the Sand. Deb Amos, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you very much.
Also with us from Washington is Seth Jones, director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at the Rand Corporation, professor at Johns Hopkins University's School for Advanced International Studies. He's served as the representative for the commander, U.S. Special Operations Command, to the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations. Seth Jones, welcome back to you as well.
Great. It's great to be on, Jane. Thanks.
Well, Deborah Amos, let's start with you. What do you make of Secretary of State John Kerry's warning to Nouri al-Maliki and this power grab, this power struggle going on apparently in Baghdad?
I think everybody's worried about how this is going to play out. Nouri al-Maliki is going to be the prime minister for another 30 days. Haider al-Abadi has 30 days to form a government. So we are in very uncharted territory in Baghdad. And I think that Secretary Kerry was responding to that. At the moment, we have U.S. airstrikes in the north. We have a humanitarian drop. But no amount of airstrikes are going to help Iraq if it can't govern itself. And so that is what we have to watch in this next month.
So, Seth Jones, if Maliki apparently here is digging in Baghdad, essentially working to maybe destabilize the central government, then you've got ISIS marching in the north. Is this a perfect storm? Are these two forces essentially guaranteeing the dissolution of Iraq?
Well, it's hard to make that prediction this early. We still have a lot more to see. But I will say this is a very, very serious situation. The use of military force, including by the United States, needs to be needs to support political objectives. And the challenge we have in Iraq right now is the political objectives, including in Iraq, are very unclear. We have a serious power grab. We have serious division within senior Iraqi leaders about the future of their country. So at the moment, the military force that the U.S. is using is being done with essentially a political vacuum in Iraq. And that is not a recipe for long-term stability. That's generally the problem with these kinds of strikes, is they're only useful if you have something that comes next that can control territory on the ground. We don't have that right now. Mm.
On Saturday, speaking from the White House lawn before leaving on his two-week vacation in Martha's Vineyard, President Obama made comments on the U.S. military involvement in Iraq. He said, no boots on the ground, and he emphasized the need for Iraqi military strength.
We can conduct airstrikes, but ultimately there's not going to be an American military solution to this problem. There's going to have to be an Iraqi solution that America and other countries and allies support.
So, Deborah Amos, the president has said the goals here in this recent mission now are to protect Americans, to stop the humanitarian crisis, don't allow safe havens, protect infrastructure. Is that possible, though, without ground forces? Is it possible just with airstrikes?
Well, what's been interesting in the last 24 hours is there's been more reporting from this trip that the U.S. Secretary of Defense took. And officials on that trip told reporters that for the first time, the U.S. will be arming Kurds directly. We've been hearing hints of this over the past couple of days. And that is new. The U.S. has been arming the Kurds through Baghdad. But now to do it directly says that they are putting their money on the Kurds to hold back ISIS. This is not really a long-term strategy, but it is certainly a tactic. And the Kurds showed in the past 12 hours that they took back two villages from ISIS, the Islamic State, near Mosul. And so there's been some momentum on the side of the Kurds. They were overwhelmed by the jihadis. They lost the Mosul Dam because they ran out of ammunition. They didn't drop their weapons, but it was a tactical withdrawal that they had to do. So let's see how they do with this, with more weapons and more support.
Seth Jones, weigh in here with the U.S. Army, with the U.S. arming the Kurds directly. How do you see the impact of that? And is the U.S. airstrike operation really having an impact to your mind?
Well, two issues here. One is when the president says no ground forces, that actually doesn't mean no ground forces. The U.S. generally does not conduct airstrikes without individuals on the ground, either U.S. intelligence or Department of Defense individuals on the ground that are calling them in. So what it does mean is that there are no large numbers of conventional forces. But I cannot imagine, I've never been involved in any bombing campaign where we don't have U.S. forces on the ground to at least call the strikes in. But more broadly on this issue, I think one of the challenges we have is we've got ISIS control of territory, in part with conjunction, with cooperation of a number of other Sunni groups like the JRTN and the Islamic Army of Iraq and several other Sunni groups. But we have U.S. airstrikes only in the some of the Kurdish areas around places like Mosul and Sinjar. So the question is going to become very quickly, is the U.S. interested in undermining ISIS or not? And I think that's the question that the president's got to decide relatively quickly.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about U.S. policy in Iraq today as the militant group ISIS remains strong there. We're speaking this hour with Deborah Amos of NPR, Middle East correspondent there. Also Seth Jones, director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at the RAND Corporation. I want to bring in another voice now from the military front. General James Dubik joins us from Washington. Retired U.S. Army Lieutenant General, he oversaw the training of the Iraqi army in 2007 and 2008 as the commander of the Multinational Security Transition Command, Iraq. Now he is a senior fellow at the Institute for the Study of War. General James Dubik, welcome to On Point. So nice to have you, sir.
Jane, thanks for the invitation. I appreciate it.
So you oversaw the training of the Iraqi army back in 2007 and 2008. What do you make of the U.S. involvement in Iraq right now?
Well, I did oversee the training then, and I think Seth had his last comment exactly right. The president has to decide on U.S. core security interest. Is it in our interest, and I believe it is, to undermine ISIS right now, to prevent them from consolidating their control over northeast Syria, north, central, and western Iraq? And airstrikes are part of that. But airstrikes alone will not advance that core security interest. Mm.
On Saturday, President Obama spoke to reporters on these U.S. airstrikes and the aid in Iraq. He was asked about the projected length of U.S. involvement, and he said it may be a long-term project.
I don't think we're going to solve this problem in weeks, if that's what you mean. I think this is going to take some time.
So, General Dubik, I'm just curious. The president was very defensive this weekend about not having troops in Iraq, remaining in Iraq. He's considered it one of his great accomplishments in his presidency to get out of Iraq. But if you look at it from the other side, isn't the reason we didn't know that ISIS was making such a rapid advance because we didn't have people on the ground?
Well, I think that there were many in the intelligence community that had seen the ISIS advance and were talking about it. So I don't think that our presence in Iraq would have given us much more information than we already had through both open source and closed source intelligence. You know, but he is right. This is not a situation that will be resolved quickly. This is going to be a months-long situation, perhaps even years, depending on what political objective the president has set. His limited aims of supporting the humanitarian assistance and protecting U.S. citizens are, from my standpoint, too narrowly drawn, and they are symptoms of the much larger problem, and that is the consolidation and control by ISIS. Mm.
So if the air campaign of some duration, whatever duration, doesn't work, General, what's next to counter these threats?
No matter, for me, Jane, what's next? I think there are several things that should be done simultaneously. Airstrikes can be part of a larger campaign that includes Iraqi special operations forces with U.S. help conducting a counter-terrorist campaign against ISIS networks. and planners, advisors to help plan and prepare a comprehensive air and ground counteroffensive, which the Iraqis cannot do alone. They're capable of doing it if they do some reorganization, some consolidation, some leadership changes, and some adequate planning. But these three things together, plus support to the Kurds and the Sunnis, who are already starting to identify themselves to help propel ISIS, these four actions together over time will increase the probability that we'll reestablish the sovereign border of Iraq and prevent ISIS from controlling a swath of Syria and Iraq.
Seth Jones, you hear what the general says here. The president has said no combat forces on the ground. Is there danger of mission creep here?
Well, yeah, I think there's always danger of mission creep, but I think there's even more danger of continuing to conduct strikes without a very clear political objective right now. And I sense that that we've gone into this with a humanitarian objective because that's what the president has said. But I don't think that's realistic at this point over the long run, in part because we have a very serious situation both in Iraq and Syria where we have an extremist group, the Islamic State of Iraq and al-Sham, or as some call it, the Levant, ISIS, that controls a greater tracts of territory. We have seen a number of Americans go to fight in the Syrian front in particular, but also the Iraqi front. We had somebody in Denver arrested this summer for trying to go to ISIS and fight in the Levant battlefields. So we have a connection. And I think the longer this group continues to try to expand its territory in both Syria and the Levant, the more dangerous it becomes for the U.S. This is, to be clear, the largest battlefield for Western foreign fighters we have seen in the modern era, bigger than Afghanistan, bigger than Iraq in the 2000s. And I think to allow this to happen, I think, would be a very serious problem for the U.S. over the next decade or so. Mm.
Let's get some callers in here, some listeners. Stephen is first from Windham, Connecticut. Hi, Stephen. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Jane. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. What a great discussion. I agree with everything the general and Seth and Deborah had to say. But Tehran, Damascus, all the Shias except for al-Sistani and Najaf have alienated the Sunnis the last 5 years. We have to do something to empower the Sunnis. And all those U.S. Marines that spent time in Anbar, you know, by the time they left, there wasn't a peep out of those guys. Why? Because they respected the Sunnis. But we can do this mission to rescue these people off the mountain. My comment is U.S. Marines, saddle up.
U.S. Marines, boots on the ground. Okay, Stephen, I hear it. Let's get another perspective from Tom in Detroit, Michigan. Hi, Tom. Welcome. You're on.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Hi. Fine. Thanks. Go ahead.
Where I'm coming from is this. President Obama said during the election to become president that he would end the war in Iraq, and he's kept his promise. He's brought our military personnel, men and women, away from, you know, taking them out of harm's way. And, you know, he doesn't need to send a large, you know, number of troops back in there. I mean, I agree partially with what with our earlier comment made about, you know, the bombings just won't do it. But, you know, to get back into a full-fledged war, we are a war-weary nation. And, I mean, that war right there, I call it an illegal invasion, it was an ill-advised war based on flawed intelligence because there was no, you know, WMDs, weapon of mass destruction, found as a reason for going in there in the first place.
So you say stay out. We're a war-weary nation, Tom. I hear you. Let me get back to Deborah Amos because I want to address Stephen's point, Deborah, about the alienation of the Sunnis and Nouri al-Maliki's effort in that, his alienation of the Sunni community. To your mind, after all our efforts, is it possible to get a political resolution here, to get the Shiite-dominated government to be more inclusive of the Sunni population?
I think that is part of the strategy, and it has to be part of the strategy. At this point, ISIS, the Islamic State, is fighting on five fronts. maybe more, and doing well in all of them. And the reason that they are is because they have local support. Sunnis in Iraq hate Nouri al-Maliki more than they hate ISIS. So that is a piece of what's happening here. Boots on the ground doesn't solve that. And it's a problem that goes back to 2010, when the U.S. and the Iranians agreed that Maliki was going to be the prime minister and the U.S. could walk away from Iraq. It was over for us. Now, every day this goes on, it will be harder to roll back ISIS without some political movement in Baghdad. And that's why the next 30 days are so important. They're, you know, Maliki is seen as the guy who alienated the Sunnis, who took the Sunni awakening and turned it around, who abandoned those people. And those people now are part of this uprising. That's why strikes alone will not do this. If you think about it, ISIS is strong in two places that are heavily populated with civilians. That's in Mosul in Iraq, and it's in Raqqa in Syria. You cannot bomb them out of those two places. It is a whole different strategy to roll back this jihadi group. And the president is right. It is going to take a long time, but we need a strategy and not a tactic.
General Dybek, what do you say to that? Do you agree?
Well, I can only agree with everything that Deborah said. Abandoning the Sunnis is certainly something that has caused, been a key cause to the problem that we have now. And the political dimension of the solution must be real inclusion of Sunnis in power-sharing agreement. But I have to go back to Tom's comment in a couple of ways. First, we are a war-weary nation. There is no doubt about it. But we're recruiting now, soldiers now, that were 4, 5, and 6 at 9/11. And if we don't go much farther along in ending this kind of situation where ISIS-controlled situation is a core threat to U.S. security, we're going to commit another generation of 4- and 5-year-olds to this problem. Mm-hmm. The war was not over when we left in Iraq in 2011, and it's not over now. It doesn't require, in my view, a large number of U.S. troops, but it will require some U.S. troops on the ground to help the Iraqis recover from their losses and conduct the counteroffensive that is required on the military sense, and will set the conditions for a return to a better political situation like we had in 2008 and 9.
Here's Jeff in Austin, Texas. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. I just wanted to express I am infuriated and really frustrated at the American media and mainstream media for creating a polarization with Barack Obama coming in and bombing this northern territory and coming back in and not even once mentioning that these people are beheading children on film and on media, executing women and men, putting women in slavery. And we call it, like, abstractly a humanitarian mission, but it's much bigger than a humanitarian mission. That we're talking about an undeniable morality in a political vacuum that we've created. And I don't understand why, or it feels like a manipulation that these things are not being brought up, and that we as an American nation are not being informed that
Jeff,
this is happening.
Thank you so much for bringing that up. Let's speak to that point for just a minute here before our break. We see pictures of this humanitarian catastrophe on Sinjar Mountain. Many, many people suffering and dying. But is there a selective outrage about humanitarian crises in the Middle East? I mean, you could make an argument that we stayed on the sidelines in Syria for years while thousands and thousands of people were killed. I mean, what's your view of that? Seth Jones, you first.
Well, I think Jeff's point is a good one. This is more than just a humanitarian issue. But I think the problem is even bigger than just Iraq itself, and even bigger than the Levant area. What we see globally, particularly in North Africa and the Middle East, is, according to a report I recently put out, almost 60% increase in the number of jihadist groups, particularly in these areas, and then a doubling of the number of jihadist fighters. And what we see is a broad push by extremists intent on establishing an extreme version of an Islamic emirate in areas they control. And ISIS, in many ways, embodies this, as we've seen not just in areas around Sinjar, is their interpretation, and it's an extreme interpretation of Islam, does involve summary executions, deep repression of women. They've used suicide bombers to kill women, children, and men as well. This is not something, I think, that we should take lightly, and not something in general that we should isolate only to the Iraq-Syria front. This does not suggest we should be involved in all these areas, but it is part of a broader trend of a resurgence of this extreme jihadism, particularly in North Africa and the Middle East.
But Deborah Amos, I mean, a lot of these things you could argue, you know, happen in Syria as well. Is there selective outrage about some of the humanitarian crises that we respond to in the Middle East?
I think in this case, because we didn't respond when the Christians, all of them, were run out of Mosul, and we didn't respond when something that some could argue is a genocide in Syria. It's a particular group of people, Sunnis, who are being attacked by the government. We didn't respond. And I would argue that primarily we responded to this one, to the Yazidis up on a mountain, more because the Kurds had to retreat from Mosul Dam and began to be pushed back into Erbil. I think that there was this notion in the White House that the Kurds could hold the line, that there was time to make more decisions. But when they started to run out of ammunition, when it became clear that they could not stand up against a jihadi group armed by the Americans. Let's remember that these people stole, picked up all the weapons that the Iraqi army dropped. So these guys were very well armed. And the Kurds could no longer hold against Erbil. And there was this notion that jihadis might even come that far. That appears to me to be the reason that there was action. Now, of course, it's a humanitarian crisis, and the U.S. responded to that. But I think that the military had a bigger portion of the decision to go ahead.
Here's some sound from yesterday's Meet the Press on NBC. Republican Congressman Peter King said that the U.S. cannot wait before hitting Iraqi militants harder.
Every day that goes by, ISIS builds up this caliphate, and it becomes a direct threat to the United States of America. They are more powerful now than al-Qaeda was on 9/11.
General Dubik, is that true to your mind? Is ISIS more powerful than al-Qaeda was on 9/11?
Well, I think they're certainly as much of a threat to us as al-Qaeda was prior to 9/11. And if you remember the years leading up to 9/11, part of the issue was we knew what was going on but took no action and allowed the threat to get worse. And in some ways, it's similar to the ISIS state. We know that ISIS is at least as bad, if not worse, than al-Qaeda. We know that ISIS wants to transfer their military control into political and social control. We see them doing it. They have eliminated the sovereign border. They're establishing more control. Their methods are as brutal as already has been described. And I think it's a core U.S. security interest not to let this kind of state establish itself.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the future for the U.S. and Iraq. We're speaking this hour with Deborah Amos of NPR, Seth Jones of RAND, and retired General James Dubik, who oversaw the training of Iraqi security forces in 2007 and 2008. Here's Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel speaking with reporters in Australia today. He said the U.S. needs to act in Iraq to protect civilians.
This is a humanitarian issue of great consequence for all of the world. And I think great powers understand they have responsibilities in these areas.
We should talk about this humanitarian crisis a little bit here. Naveen, to that point, is calling from Austin, Texas. Naveen, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hi, Jane. Yeah, this is Naveen. I am Yazidi from Sinjar. And I'm calling from Austin, Texas. My family was in Sinjar when this attack took place. And this genocide against Yazidi It's correct. Everything is happening. It's correct. They are slaughtering people. They are killing minorities, Shiite, Yazidis, Christian. They are giving them choice, but Yazidis, they're not giving them any choice. They buried 500 civilians under the ground, alive. They took 500 to 700 Yazidi women as sex slaves.
Have you been able to find your family? Do you know if they're okay?
My family finally made it to a safe place in Kurdistan last night. They were in the mountain without food, without water for a whole week, plus being scared of ISIS because they were chasing people to the mountain and trying to kill them.
Naveen, I'm really glad that you called, and I hope that you have some contact with your family and that they are safe. It is a horrific scene there. Seth Jones, can you speak to this? I mean, where do we stand as far as these refugees are on the mountain, on Mount Sinjar?
Well, the interesting reality and the sad reality is for a period of 2012, 2013, and early 2014, the vast majority of refugees in this region were coming from Syria to Iraq to escape the fighting. Now we have refugees from Iraq trying to go to some into Jordan, some up into Kurdish areas, and the most significant safe zones now, including for some of the Yazidi refugees, really internally displaced if they're staying within Iraq, are in Kurdish-controlled areas. The challenge is if they move into deeper into areas of the west, they're getting into ISIS-controlled areas, and if they're moving into the Mosul area, they're getting into ISIS-controlled areas. So there are areas up into the mountains of Kurdistan where ISIS control is virtually non-existent, and they're largely protected by Kurdish Peshmerga and other forces. That for the moment, appears to be the safest within Iraq, unless they can get outside. Mm.
Deborah Amos, would you add to that what Seth Jones just said? You've spent so much time there. How do you see it?
Well, what we have to remember is al-Qaeda went after the Yazidis in Sinjar in 2007. And in some ways, for some of these jihadis, this is unfinished business. Unlike the Christians, who they said you can convert or we'll kill you or you can leave, they fleeced them of anything of value as they were moving out of Mosul. There is a different reaction to Yazidis. They have no choice. They are beyond the pale in terms of how the jihadis look at them. So they pursued them into the mountain. It's different than we've seen with other minority groups. And that is why this is so dire for this community. Mm. It's not just a matter of escaping up the mountain and then you're safe. No, these people were pursuing them up the mountain. There are snipers who are taking out people. So their only safety is in Kurdistan. Now, I have to say that Kurdistan is being overwhelmed. They had all these Syrian Kurds who came. They had the entire Christian population of Mosul who had no place else to go. They already have Christians from Baghdad from an earlier attempt by jihadis to cleanse Baghdad of its Christian community. So there's a second step that we're all going to have to look at. And I think the UN is already trying to move as fast as they can, but there's going to be another appeal for this huge wave of humanity into the one safe place that's left when you're going east out of these regions.
Let's make a little turn here with some sound from Republican Senator John McCain yesterday on CNN's State of the Union. He's calling for airstrikes not only in Iraq but in Syria against ISIS and Islamic State forces. He said the situation in Iraq is turning into a regional conflict that particularly poses a threat to the security of the United States of America.
We are the enemy. They want to destroy us. They're getting stronger all the time. They have attracted 1,000 young men from around the world who are now fighting on their side. This ISIS is metastasizing throughout the region. And their goal, as they have stated openly time after time, is the destruction of the United States of America.
What's the homeland terrorist threat from ISIS, General Dubik?
Well, the threat is not immediate. The threat is not existential, but the threat is very similar to the kinds of attacks that resulted in the 9/11 2001 attacks. Since 9/11, we all have read about the number of attempted attacks that luckily our intelligence and security services have foiled. So there's no abatement in the attempt of Al-Qaeda and ISIS in the same ilk to try to attack the U.S. on our soil and U.S. interests abroad.
General, Hillary Clinton this weekend told The Atlantic that the U.S. failure to help Syrian rebels actually led to the rise of ISIS in the region. Do you agree with that?
I do think that we should have done and we should do more to assist the Syrian groups. I think we have been very narrow in our view of how to approach this. We have a very good unconventional warfare capacity in our special forces and our clandestine services, and we should make more of that.
Deborah Amos, how was ISIS able to, as a group, this sort of ragtag group of militant fighters, how was it able to rise so far so fast?
Well, they were beaten down in 2007 in Iraq, and as we discussed earlier, in some ways it was the policies of Nouri al-Maliki that undid what was called the Sunni Awakening. And it was really the war in Syria that gave them a huge break. They were able to cross the border. They had a shakedown operation in Mosul, and that was going on for years, where they would essentially, like the mafia, where they would collect, $500 a month from every pharmacist in Mosul. And that is how they funded their operation in Syria. They very cleverly fought against the Assad regime somewhat, but what they were really after was to set up a base of operations. And they did that in the city of Raqqa, where they have been governing for more than a year. They also very strategically took the oil fields in eastern Syria. So they have become essentially self-financing. And success builds on success. You know, they were the biggest, the smartest, the most well-armed, the richest organization in Syria, and that attracted people at a time when the rest of the rebels in Syria were abandoned by everybody else. So they have grown without any challenge from anyone for more than a year. And now we see the result when they took Mosul and now have control of two major cities, one of 2 million people, that's Mosul, and one of about 1 million people, and that's Raqqa in Syria.
Here's President Obama on Saturday speaking with reporters, saying that the power and the growth of the militant group ISIS was originally underestimated.
There is no doubt that their advance, their movement over the last several months has been more rapid than the intelligence estimates and I think the expectations of policymakers both in and out of, outside of Iraq.
Seth Jones, how did that happen? How did we underestimate them?
Well, I'm not entirely sure we did underestimate them. U.S. Military and intelligence agencies had been analyzing the growth in ISIS violence over the past several years. And between 2011 and 2012, 2011 was the last year U.S. forces were in Iraq. By 2012, ISIS violence roughly doubled. By 2013, it had quadrupled. And that was captured by U.S. government analysts that were looking at the situation in Iraq. I think what caught some people by surprise was the speed with which ISIS actually was able to co-opt allies and then control territory. But I think I actually don't think it's accurate to say that it caught U.S. government officials, or at least analysts that were looking at Iraq, by surprise, because I talked to a number of them who over the early part of 2014 were extremely nervous about the direction that Iraq was going in, especially when ISIS made a bid on some of the towns in and cities in western Iraq, ones that Al-Qaeda in Iraq had been, in Anbar province, had been so significant in the mid-2000s. Mm.
Let's get back to the phone. So many callers here. David is first from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, David. Welcome. Thanks for waiting.
Thank you so much. I just have a quick question. Before we attacked Iraq, Colin Powell and many world leaders said, if you break it, you have to fix it. Now we have three major territories in Iraq, each completely distinct, Shiite, Sunni, Kurdish. Now, why is it that we must put together these three states into one big state? Simply because the British had done it?
David, thank you. General Dubik, I'll let you respond to that. Splitting Iraq into three parts, what do you think?
Well, I think there are many Iraqis that don't want to split in three parts either. If the federalization project would have taken some legs in 2004 and 2005, perhaps it was the right. It may have been the right thing to do, but it didn't, and it didn't even inside of Iraq. Certainly, you can find some proponents of splitting of Iraq, but the issue now is the Sunni portion, if it would split, would be not a benign part of a federalized Iraq. It would be very much malignant, and malignant not just to the region, but malignant to U.S. and Western interests. This is the same kind of sanctuary that ISIS has now created that we have been fighting for 13 years to prevent. And I'd like to also jump on your question, Jane, about surprise. ISIS and al-Qaeda in Iraq before them and ISIS when they changed their name have actually conducted several campaigns beginning in mid-2012 into 2013 that rebuilt themselves, reestablished their networks, used prison breaks to reestablish their leadership, set the conditions for their attack down the Tigris, and set the conditions for their attack down the Euphrates to Fallujah. So there was really no surprise from my perspective.
And can I also say, Jane,
yes,
that it was well reported. It was well reported. There, you can read tons of articles about ISIS in Raqqa, ISIS in Syria, ISIS in Fallujah. Just Google it and you will see.
Harry's in Chester, Vermont. Harry, welcome to On Point.
Hello.
Hi.
Nothing's been mentioned about the word, the three-letter word, oil.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an oil trader, and if those terrorists who get close to those oil fields, which are 110 miles south of Baghdad, you're looking at $160 a barrel of oil and $12 to $15 a gallon of gas at the pump. They are an existential threat to the world oil economy because there's only a $1 million barrel per day cushion, and right now the Iraqis are producing 3,600,000 barrels.
Harry, thank you. Seth Jones, you know that dirty little piece of this, oil, oil, oil. How do you see it?
Well, I think the most serious threat to the U.S. is the security threat that that Deborah and General Dubik and I have referred to several different times. On the oil issue, you know, there is oil in multiple locations, including ISIS now control of some locations in Kurdish areas. I do think this is an issue, and ISIS has shown a proclivity to try to finance itself by seizing bank accounts and some oil fields. I'm not clear. I'm not an economist. I'm not clear about the extent of the threat it would pose to the global oil economy. It's certainly something to consider. But again, I would respond by saying, in my view, the most serious threat, and it's a regional one now. And I would add that we've seen this fight expand not just in Iraq and in Syria, but more recently into Lebanon, including over the weekend with Sunni strikes against Shia villages in Lebanon. That this is probably the most serious part, and really the reason, if the U.S. is going to intervene, the primary motivation is security interest to the U.S.
It's been pointed out that President Obama is the fourth president in a row to order military action in Iraq. Deborah Amos, we've got about a minute here. Does this consume the president for the rest of his term?
Well, if he wants to prevent a regional sectarian war, I think he has to. We are on that trajectory, and it doesn't look good. As I said, ISIS is fighting on more than five fronts and doing well. This is the first time we have seen their momentum reversed. That has to go much further to make sure that the region remains stable. There are 2 million refugees in Lebanon. We could get to those numbers coming into Kurdistan. So we are looking at a very destabilized region, and that is dangerous.
Seth Jones, your thought?
I think Deborah's exactly right. I think that's a very, very serious concern. I would advocate increase in U.S. activity against ISIS more broadly in Iraq, but it has to be done by supporting political changes, particularly with the Maliki government. Long-term success cannot happen without it.
General Dubik, I'll give you the quick last word here. Does this consume the president for the rest of his time in office? General Dubik? We lost the general. General Dubik was the former commander of Multinational Security Transition Command in Iraq, now the senior fellow at the Institute for Study of War. General, thank you very much for your time today. Seth Jones, director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at the RAND Corporation. Seth, I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thanks, Jane.
And Deborah Amos, Middle East correspondent for NPR News. Deborah, thank you.
Thank you, Jane.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.